Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
That's why I'm saying this is like dealing with a grifter. A grifter who is always trying for an advantage to himself. Think of election promises and think of transactions. Think of something that he's going to get back and he can brag about and he can put that on his PR CV.
Well, as much as you'd like to, you just can't seem to get away from Trump and his tough talk on tariffs these days. It's dominating the news and, quite frankly, putting the fear of God into a lot of big businesses around the world, and I reckon in the Irish government too. But what exactly are tariffs? How do they work and why should we care about them? One person I've often turned to when I wanted to understand complex economic concepts is economist Konstantin Gurdjieff. Konstantin used to live in Ireland, teach in Trinity, and during the big economic recession, he was all over the media, particularly on Vincent Brown's Tonight with Vincent Brown show, breaking down what was going on in the world in layman's terms. He became so kind of prominent that I even started doing sketches of him. I used to portray him as a kind of a Bond villain who used to be stroking a pussycat on the Vincent Brown show, because he had a very distinctive kind of Russian accent, as you will hear in this interview. It's kind of related a little bit to Jose Mourinho, but it's not. It's much higher, so it was like the meerkat in the simples.com ads. And so I used to say simples and all this sort of stuff. But he had a sort of a Dublin accent as well, you know, Jesus Christ, because he was living in Dublin and all this sort of stuff. So Konstantin has been a fantastic economist for years. He lives in the US now, so I thought he was the perfect guest for this week to talk about all the Trump's tough talk on tariffs, life, and the general mood in the US politically, the barometer, how it's feeling over there. And also, as a Russian man living abroad, how he feels about what is happening in his home country. Remember, when you listen to this interview, Konstantin's mother lives in Russia, and she has some very interesting views of her own.
People literally are divided. Teams of volleyball players are divided on the basis of political kind of allegiance of their parents, for example, okay? It isn't the United Nations anymore. One of the things you learn after having a lifetime of experience with economics is that stop making prognostications, because you will never be right unless randomly. So don't trust any economist who says X will happen. Actually, you probably are better off betting that Y will happen as a result of that, okay? You know, she's a kind of firm supporter of what Putin is doing. It's impossible to talk to her about this. So we kind of try to talk about friends, family, the weather, and, you know, things like that.
Do you know what the name of their song was?
No, go for it.
I Fell in Love with a Disabled Army Veteran.
No, you're kidding me.
It was. Korean song that won the Intervision Song Contest.
Well, there is hope then. DEI is obviously penetrating North Korea as well, rapidly. You know, it will take it down too.
This is a very eye-opening conversation, and I think you'll find it interesting to hear the perspective of a Russian person living in the US talking about tariffs around the world and how that feels right now. But there's another economist who has a lot to say about Trump and tariffs, and he's getting it all off his chest on his podcast. Ready to go, David?
Let's do it, John.
Okay, let's just do macroeconomics. Is it spot on?
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant.
Hands up. Here we go. How are you doing there? It's David here.
And John.
And today we're talking about trade tariffs and macroeconomics.
Oh, heavy.
Heavy, John. But I'm going to break it down so that anybody can capture the simple idea.
As only you can, David.
You said it, John. Trump's reciprocal global tariffs.
Oof, that's a mouthful.
It is, John. And these tariffs are different tariffs. Yeah. Because you know what they remind me of, John?
No, not at all.
They remind me of the rough days back in the slum holes of Dorky in the early 80s.
Jesus, not this
and
again.
John, the Dandel scumbags, remember them?
No.
They were trying to come over the border into Dorky, and I put a 24% bleeding tariff on cans of Carlsberg Elephant Brew.
And
50% on Linden Village. Jesus, we battered them in the Battle of Vico Road. Remember that, John?
No, I don't remember
and
the Battle
was
of Vico Road.
Smashed open. Yeah. And didn't I build a wall all around Dorky down to Cowley Mar, fucking Harbour.
You're mentally
so
ill.
That
good
the
luck.
The Torags couldn't get in. And the tourists, they thought it was a medieval wall. But the only thing medieval about it, John, was me getting medieval on the knackered. this is a scumbag. John.
Great to hear from David again. I love those David McWilliam sketches. And of course, exclusive comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And speaking of comedy, I'll have the hilarious Norma Sheehan on the podcast later in February. The comic, actor, and now turned stand-up as well. She's currently on a nationwide tour of It's Wine O'Clock. Norma will be in the Cork Opera House on February 23rd. And I will highly recommend that you go along if you can to see her. Or if you're not in the real capital, as she would say herself, she'll be in the Gaelic in Dublin on May 11th and loads of other places around the country in between. Check out Norma Sheehan, type her in there and see where she's on tour, and she'll be on this podcast very soon as well. Also, I am delighted to welcome and thank with open arms our brand new sponsor, Deluxe Bathrooms, as the new sponsor of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Deluxe Bathrooms is Ireland's premium bathroom and tile retailer. And if you're dreaming of a bathroom that combines luxury, functionality and style, well, then look no further. Deluxe Bathrooms has you covered, and at a great price too. And listen, during this month and up till March 2nd, they have the Love Your Bathroom sale, which is now on, and you can save up to 70% store-wide on Europe's biggest brands. Freestanding baths from $699, shower screens $199, etc, etc. Prices have been slashed on all the premium products that you'll need to create the bathroom of your dreams. We did a sketch about them last week, Michael D and Sabina trying to get a downstairs toilet fixed from Deluxe Bathrooms into the Oras and Uachtaráin and charged to expenses, and it went down really well. Check out the Love Your Bathroom sale in store at Dundalk Retail Park and Little Island in Cork, or online at deluxebathrooms.ie. The sale is on now, and it's a must-see sale, and it must end on March 2nd. Okay, thank you to Deluxe Bathrooms. I reckon Donald Trump would love some of the great deals to be found in this sale and how he would negotiate them. But how much more might he be paying to import them over to the US if he ends up introducing these tariffs he's talking about? Let's cross straight over to the US, where Konstantin Gurdjieff is waiting to break it all down for us. Let's go. Konstantin, thank you so much for joining me again on the podcast. Always a great pleasure to talk to you. And to get an insight, I know you're living over in America and you're teaching over in America. So maybe to get an insight onto what's happening over in America from a first-hand point of view, but also to get an insight into maybe what's happening in Russia, because we know you have family in Russia as well. And we know that that Russia-Ukraine situation might be reaching a denouement maybe in the year 2025. But first of all, let's talk about America. Konstantin, this is Trump's America now. We see what's going on. I'm fascinated by some of the discussion around the economics, the simple economics that he talks about. So, for example, his favorite word in the English language, tariff. This is real two-year-old stuff now. Tell my listeners, what is a tariff? What does a tariff do? What are the upsides of a tariff for you and the downsides of a tariff for you?
So in basic terms, a tariff is like a tax. It's a tax which is imposed at the border, and it is imposed on the movement of goods and services across the border. So when, say, for example, an American company produces something in Ireland and ships that into the United States, if United States imposes tariffs against Ireland, then that company will have to pay this tariff, that rate, to the American equivalent of the American exchequer, to the U.S. Treasury. Mm. So all of that sounds fairly innocuous until you realize the volume of trade between Ireland and the United States, until you realize that that trade is backing materially jobs in Ireland, and it is certainly contributing to the revenue of the exchequer in Ireland, which is tremendous contribution, yes? I mean, Ireland is number one in terms of the overall exports share that goes to the United States in Europe at 27.6% in 2023. And this is the largest share in Europe by far. Second largest would be Switzerland with about 15%. Okay. And the UK, we think, is like just 13%. So as a result of that, this tax, this tariff itself, is getting distributed then back into the economy, both in the United States on the consumer side, who is facing the higher prices and higher costs of goods and services being supplied to them, not just by the foreign, exporters, those who are paying the tariff, but also by the domestic producers, who can now raise some of their prices somewhat to, basically reap or get higher rates of return and higher profitability. Okay. As a result of this.
Okay, so let's say Kerrygold butter costs $2, and Trump puts a 25% tariff or a 50% tariff on Kerrygold butter. That means that Kerrygold butter will be raised from $2 to $3. Will it? Or no, it won't. Kerrygold will have to pay another dollar.
This is not entirely true, okay? So what will happen is that the Kerrygold will have to pay $1. But on the consumer side in the United States, there are different intermediaries who are putting the putting Kerrygold onto the market shelf, yes? And those intermediaries will probably reduce somewhat their own profit margins in order to make sure that Kerrygold butter actually still continues to sell. By how much, we don't know. So the pass-through rate from the actual tariff, or basically how much of the tariff gets passed through to the bottom line of the consumer in the United States, is not one for one. It depends on the whole structure of the supply chain management. It depends on the intermediaries, such as, for example, agents who represent these goods in the United States market, who place them onto the shelves. And ultimately, it also depends on the supermarkets. Now, here's the problem. Over the recent years, we have seen a tremendous consolidation in the United States groceries retailing. There is basically near monopolies now, with the dominant players controlling, you know, three dominant players controlling more than 80% of the market share. So as a result of that, this kind of pass-through mechanism, where some of the cost shocks can be absorbed and consumers can experience a little bit of the relief relative to tariffs, is probably not going to be available. So as a result of that, especially for the smaller producers like Kerrygold, which doesn't have a huge share in the market in the United States. So as a result of that, we probably are going to see on the American side a significant impact of those tariffs in terms of the goods and services, cost of goods and services, which kind of goes against what Trump has been promising from the from both electoral trails and since he came into the White House as well.
So you said in a recent tweet, right, you said Trump does not have a clue what he is doing. He is a grifter pretending to be a surgeon as he's heading right into the operating theater. Okay, so with this in mind, I mean, what is Trump thinking he's doing?
So there is a lot of interesting dynamic in both in my tweet and also in what is happening around what Trump is doing and what he is planning to do. So, you know, a lot of us, analysts in trade, finance, even geopolitical space, economists, you know, financial markets people, have been sitting back for the last, you know, basically 2 months plus, and sitting out the storm, the mess. We are hoping to find some strand of direction that can make sense, direction of policy and policy objectives. There seems to be nothing that is unifying Trump's policy missives so far, with exception of perhaps two things. One, they all follow his election promises. President Trump has been delivering exactly what he said he will deliver, even though back when he was saying it, all of us has deemed it to be incomprehensible and all of us has deemed it to be contradictory. The second thing that is important to understand in terms of what President Trump is doing is that everything that he's doing is transactionally motivated. You do A or we will whack you with Z. So it's kind of like, you know, that's where I'm saying this is like dealing with a grifter who is always trying for an advantage to himself. That advantage can be in areas that are really big policy decision-making, such as trade rebalancing, something we started talking with, yes, transactionalism in international relations, Mexico and Canada borders, things that are really big ticket stuff. Some of them can be really petty. And, you know, things like happening, for example, with national security personnel, retirees, and their clearance, security clearance. Some are just plain incomprehensible, things like Greenland, Panama Canal, which no one can understand where he's coming from. And oh, by the way, the latest conversations that he's having about the Ukraine-Russia war and ending the Ukraine-Russia war also fit into this incomprehensible space, because the things that he's talking about are really kind of strangely, bizarrely tangential to the actual conflict, such as the rare earth minerals and things like that. And then some of the things that he's doing apparently and are yet to come, such as China and other things, are self-motivated. They're motivated by the idea of him being a great statesman. And again, Ukraine-Russia war comes into that play as well. So in basic terms, if you want to try to understand what he is doing, think of election promises and think of transactions. think of something that he's going to get back and he can brag about, and he can put that on his effectively PR CV.
In terms of a template, were, you know, the templates of the Earth's crust be moved in terms of being an economist? You must be there right now with all your economist friends. Basically, everything you understand, believe in, studied, taught, appreciate, take as for granted, has been turned down and shaken like a box by this guy. It doesn't make any sense. Now, can you see any situation in your economic world where this doesn't end in tears economically?
Well, I can see that kind of scenario, and I can see that scenario because primarily I have been disillusioned with the economics profession to begin with for a good part of about, you know, 15 years now, if not longer. So for those of us who have been so-called contrarians, what Trump is doing today is a logical denouement of the process by which we arrived at today. We debased basic institutions of trust in our societies. And I mean by societies, I mean Western societies. It applies to Europe as much as it applies to the United States. You look at the trust barometers since the global financial crisis, and every one of them screaming at us that there is no trust in government, that the public, the voters, do not perceive the governments to act in their own interest, that the economic, you know, misalignment and economic costs are now weighing so heavily on the core middle class, both in Europe and in the United States, and also in Asia as well, by the way. It's not just to say it is only limited to the United States or Europe. Across the North America as well, the middle class is disappearing. The middle class is disappearing not by going into the upper class, but actually by sinking below. I mean, all of that, and, you know, if you think about some other political agendas that have been promoted in recent, you know, decade and a half, you can then trace back to the, you know, rising of Trump, rising of the populist movements. We can see that in all of the elections that have taken place since the COVID pandemic, in all of these elections, the kind of center-right or center-left governments that were present in place during the pandemic have been booted out of the office, replaced with something more brash, more loud,
yeah,
more present. We normalize that. In case of Europe, take Italy, for example. When Meloni was elected, it was the end of the days. We were having the fascists coming into power in Italy, and everyone from Brussels all the way to individual capitals was screaming, how are we going to deal with the third largest economy in Europe being run by this, you know, extremist political party and political leader? And now Meloni is mainstream. Now Meloni is effectively being viewed as the core, you know, reliable partner within the European Union. So I'm not saying she isn't, by the way. I'm just saying that we have normalized everything by now, and we normalized Trump. So when Trump comes into power right now and literally says, you know, you remember me promising to back Mexico? You remember me promising to take out China and shoot it in the back of the shed? Yeah, here it is. Watch me do it, you know? And we all go, you know, gasping for air because of it.
Great, but I'm flooding the zone. Really, Steve Bannon's flooding the zone as well. This idea that there's so much shit hitting the fan that you can't even deal with anything. Like, I remember seeing this shoal of fish. I remember seeing the herds of wildebeest, and the lion goes off to the herds of wildebeest, and the wildebeest get into the tightest herd they can, so that basically the more wildebeest there are, the less a lion can concentrate on an individual indivisi to pick off. It's just like, you don't know where to start. As soon as one goes by you, the other one's there, and you before you know, they're long. I have a theory, Constantine, and you can riff off this theory if you wouldn't mind, because the theory is this, that all empires come to an end. The American Empire is, as they've always said, an experiment, which is now 250 years old. But the way the empire was designed, in other words, by the founders, as they call them, the Constitution, allowed for such things as total free speech, the ability to acquire property, the ability to become really rich, to deify money, to deify acquisition, to then in your popular culture, to deify fame, to be on TV, to have the right to a lawyer, to have the right to as many lawyers as you want, to have the right to afford better and more lawyers than another guy, to say what you want, to insult who you want, to become famous, to go on TV, to become rich, to go on TV to say what you want. And then finally, popular voting. Vote now for your favorite artist. Vote now for your favorite singer. The lines are open now. Vote now for your favorite businessman. He has been the ultimate end game of what the American idea is. In other words, they have created a machine, a monster, that has gamed the system. The American people, the American idea, didn't know it, but it was asking for Trump all along. And now, we possibly, with the way the courts are in America at the moment, the courts are right up against it, possibly facing the actual end of democracy. If Trump's DOJ refuses to enforce court orders, that is effectively the end of democracy.
In a way, you are right. Foundations of every empire or every superpower decline are laid down into basically the foundations of its original strength, okay? That kind of level of competition, that level of reliance on merit, that level of reliance. And, you know, like, look, the last fall's Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics went to three researchers who actually kind of codified that way of thinking in terms of how institutions of competitiveness and merit has arisen in North America and did not arise in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies. Yeah, I mean, you know, Acemoglu, Johnson, these people have written about it for many years. What they did not actually write about is something that is more important to me in what you just said. And that is the idea that that continuity of those systems gets corrupted over a period of time. And that corruption leads ultimately to decline. Roman Empire probably, and I'm not a historian, but from what I remember, Roman Empire probably has gone through exactly the same. Virtue to riches to decline. The problem is that the society needs renewals. It always needs shocks to be able to renew, okay? European society is lucky in being very unlucky in the 20th century, having survived through and existed through the World War II, which it actually is originated, yes, from there. But as a result of that, European society has acquired a certain degree of humbleness, which is perhaps currently is being eroded as well, but hasn't been yet fully eroded. American society went from strength to strength to strength to strength, from economic strength to the military strength, from military strength to geopolitical strength. Geopolitical strength is rested now on the military strength. And all of a sudden, the hubris of overconfidence, the hubris of overspending, overreach, has now been chipping slowly at the facade of the economy to the point where the American economy currently is settled with enormous levels of debt. Debt which is private, debt which is public. Yeah, sure, Japan has more public debt and so forth. United States is facing in 2025 $9.2 trillion of its debt maturing in just 1 year. $9.2 trillion. This is so massive that we're seeing the kind of, if you want, within the Washington, amongst the contrarians like Trump, a gut reaction that this cannot be financed, that cannot be carried through.
Just a quick question. What happens when the debt matures, $9.2 trillion? What happens? You're asked for it back. You have to pay.
No. You swap it. Yes, I mean, no country ever pays its debts. I mean, come on.
But why is it so big then?
So because if you have the $9.2 trillion, that's because we've issued more recently a lot of debt, and most of the debt that the United States has been issuing has been shorter-term debt rather than longer-term debt. I mean, you know, Italians haven't learned quite the lesson or weren't really able to learn the lesson. So their debt maturity period has been very much stable since the pre-global financial crisis and onwards. But say countries like Ireland and TMA has done a fantastic work in this sense. We extended significantly maturity of debt. So we don't have this huge bulk of debt maturing in ongoing kind of very short period of time. Mm. United States didn't do that, primarily because the United States debt, it is reliant on the global markets much more than anyone else. When it is reliant on the global markets much more than anyone else, it also is reliant increasingly on private markets for debt replacement rather than, you know, swapping the, you know, maturing debt with the new debt, rather than on sovereign wealth funds or, say, for example, things like treasuries. Official reserves in the U.S. dollar are declining.
Okay.
While the private reserves or private investments in the U.S. dollar are increasing.
Okay.
So as a result of that, the U.S. is not in a very healthy fiscal position at all.
Okay. If you were Ireland, would you be worried at the moment?
Yes and no. Okay. There are several things here. Okay. So first of all, tariffs. Tariffs, as I mentioned before, are going to impact Ireland, especially tariffs against the EU. Most of the goods and services that we're exporting to the United States, and again, Ireland's currently fourth largest trade surplus vis-a-vis the United States in last year. The number one would be China, $295 billion, Mexico, $170 billion, Vietnam, $124-ish billion, and Ireland is fourth, okay,
wow.
With $87 billion.
Literally fourth.
Almost. Literally fourth,
jeepers.
Yes. So that's significant. But the good news is most of the tariffs that he's trying to impose will be not on the goods that are being traded by multinationals across the border. Most mm-hmm. of Irish experts, vast majority of Irish experts into the United States, are multinationals. Basically, American companies shipping stuff back into the United States that they produce somewhere else than ship via Ireland and so forth. So as a result of that, we are probably okay in the short term when it comes to tariffs threats, because we have multinationals doing our bidding in the White House, and they have very significant sway.
Mm.
So assuming that Trump is a rational agent, probably Ireland is going to stay relatively better off than other countries in terms of the tariffs. Where the threat comes in is the domestic policies of Trump administration, and in particular, say, for example, things like tax policies. So one of the things that he removed already United States from is the OECD's Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Paris-based U.S.-funded organization, which was in charge of the kind of coordinating global tax policies vis-a-vis the larger multinationals. These policies would have placed the onus on collection of the minimum global tax rate of 15%. On the country where this, you know, they operate, those multinationals operate, Ireland would have been standing to gain quite significant windfall from the U.S. multinationals, which pay less than 15% statutory tax, including Apple. Now, Apple is about, I think, 14-something percent currently, so it's not a huge amount, but would be hundreds of millions of dollars still. So Exchequer is now not going to collect that because Trump has taken the United States out of the OECD mm-hmm. process and actually instructed his own treasury officials and his other officials to investigate the country's compliance with, or not compliance, but the country tax laws vis-a-vis the dual taxation treaties and vis-a-vis the kind of global tax efforts. Mm. So we might get into the crosshair on that front. More importantly, however, in the longer term, Trump is very aggressive in terms of incentivizing onshoring of production back into the United States. This reimportation, whereby U.S. companies produce stuff in Ireland and elsewhere and then reimport these goods and services into the United States.
But doesn't that take a long time to kind of solidify?
Very, very long time. It would require an act of Congress, which he controls, but it will take some time. It will be major tax reforms. What we know from the tax reforms so far that he's pushing for, the most dangerous things would be, like, say, for example, full expensing of R&D expenses, something that is a big conduit for tax optimization via Ireland. And then another thing is also 15% domestic production tax rate. So basically, reduction in terms of the corporate taxes.
Okay.
Again, that would take years. And here, you remember when you started at the very beginning, you said, you know, what's the good news here? Yes, you kind of mentioned kind of possibility of what can be the good news. The good news is that we might outlast Trump.
Yes, that's what I was thinking, because of the economic cycle and the time it takes to get things done outlasts the political cycle.
And remember that the political cycle in the United States is not 4 years.
No, it's two.
It's two, exactly. A lot of people don't understand it, don't realize
it. Yeah, I mean, we had a hint of that yesterday when Fox News asked the most impertinent question ever of Trump. Brett Baer asked Trump, so in 2 years, is J.D. Vance your nominee? And he just went, no. He was just furious because it reminded him how short your leash on power is.
Which is amazing because, of course, you know, we know that historically that most of the presidents do outline or set the foundations for their presidency within the first 100 days, the honeymoon period, but it really is a power period. Yes, Trump is one of the probably most active presidents other than Lyndon B. Johnson so far in his term, in this second term, in terms of kind of ambition and the outline in his agenda. So a lot of this agenda is innocuous from the Irish perspective, and a lot of this agenda actually can be beneficial if Ireland plays that well.
Yes,
okay?
Interesting.
You know, I mean, as far as, and it's a big open question here, and it's one of the reasons why a lot of us on the analysis side has difficulty reading Trump, is he's so transactional that the idea of alliances, that the idea of stable long-term relationships, and, you know, is very tenuous, very questionable. Denmark is a great example. Denmark has been a long-term ally with the United States. The United States has bases on Greenland. It actually dramatically reduced over the last couple decades its military presence on Greenland, but it still has a base on Greenland. Denmark has been a stalwart ally within the NATO and within the trade and economic relations partnership with the United States. None of that matters. None of that counts when it comes to people like Trump.
Interesting. A political question. You're in America. You have colleagues, you have friends, family. Do you see what's going on at the moment and regard this as different politically? What's going on at the moment? And if you do regard it as politically, do you think we're reaching or close to a perhaps an existential tipping point?
Well, I live in a blue state, so-called blue state, which votes Democrat. We have a Democratic, LGBTQ governor who is very popular in many ways. Yet the state is literally actually divided. Physically, it was about half a mile from me here. There's a freeway which cuts north-south through the state of Colorado and divided into two halves. One half, my side, is blue. The other side is completely red. The disconnect between those things is such that people literally are divided. Teams of volleyball players are divided on the basis of political kind of allegiance of their parents, for example. Okay, it isn't a united nation anymore. It isn't a nation that is presenting a coherent picture of perhaps ideological disagreement, but at the same time, will to work together. And that gap is very big. You have angry people in blue states. The people who would vote Republican would be on the kind of anger side. On the other hand, the Democrats in the red states are angry. I was recently in Texas, for example, and was in a car with a driver who was, Democrat. And she spent the entire drive really venting anger at the Republicans. So you have the country so deeply divided that when Trump stepped into the White House, you had cheers and you had literally, high-fiving in my gym from the Republican supporters of his. And you had, the Democrats, people who would be voting the opposite way, feeling depressed. So the reality is the country falls when that unity of purpose, when that unity of identity falls apart. In the West, we have undermined the unity of identity. We have undermined identity tremendously. Ireland is going through that process as well. And I remember Ireland as a much more unified, much more coherent society where we were all driven by the idea that things can be better, we can improve them, we can continue growing together, we are part of Europe and so forth. There was positive agenda on the social side and so forth. A lot of now what is coming out of Ireland is a negative agenda. It's a reactionary agenda, yes. Reaction to perhaps excessive policies, yes. Reaction perhaps to the policies that have failed, yes. Housing, immigration, you name it, okay? We have those failures. But the fact is that in the past we were able to deal with those things, perhaps on a glacial kind of scale, time scale, perhaps not fast enough for our liking, but at the very least there was a progress. Now we've seen in the United States, in the political, in the media, and in economic spheres, the same thing that we're seeing, say, for example, in Ireland, in the microcosm, and it is much more visible. Repeated conversation about the failures, the repeated conversations about lack of governance, the repeated conversations about the mistrust, the society fabric underlined holding us together, giving us identity as, whether we're an American or an Irish person or European, that fabric is torn. And the question is only now whether it's irreparably torn or can it be somehow repatched back? And I'm not sure I have an answer to it, primarily because I'm scared of the answer I have to it.
A few of the things there, Constantine, we live in a world as well where the vast majority of people who vote and the vast majority of people who are alive don't remember dictatorships. They didn't live through it. So they can actually be asked on the street, excuse me, sir, would you like to see Trump as a dictator? Absolutely. We goddamn need a dictator. We need a dictator. That's exactly what we need. Try it for 1 week being a dictator. Try have the people up against the walls being shot. Try, you know, your house taken off you. Try totalitarianism. You know, try a kleptocracy. Try anything you want. So that's
the thing about this is that if you go back to the histories of dictatorships, very few dictatorships really started with a transparent way of suppression. Most of it,
they got in slyly with democracy.
Exactly. And they try to control also the narrative and they try to control the media. Today, the United States media is fully controlled and fully owned. You can see even social media effectively suppressing dissenting voices. And that is true for everyone, including the likes of, say, for example, X/Twitter. Okay. So, and this suppression is happening from the upper echelons of power, where it is economic power, such as the oligarchs, leading that through their own social media channels that they control, or it is the political oligarchs, the likes of President Trump today, but also before him, the President Biden and so forth, the administrations, and in the Irish case, the Irish government, which are leading that suppression as well. So when we say that, yeah, look, you know, you voted for being basically taken out and shot, and now you're getting shot. There's no one listening because nobody can hear us saying that you are getting shot.
Yes. Okay. That's really well put. Yeah. We know what it is, except nobody's listening. That's an interesting way of putting it, because we often ask ourselves that question. Can anybody hear this? Can anybody see this?
Yeah. And when you think about this, you know, that's why you and I talked last time we met about that as well. The power of the more independent journalism is becoming so much greater, but the voice of it is becoming more and more suppressed.
I want to ask you about Russia. Which family do you have in Russia?
Well, my mother is still there. I mean, I have a lot of friends.
What age is she now, Constantine?
She is now 78.
She's young.
Yeah, she's in good health as well. Mm. You know, I mean, which is, you know, fingers crossed, you know, knock on wood, you know.
What's her name?
Katerina, and she lives in Moscow. You know, we have a summer house that she tends to in the summer. You know, she's always been very reluctant to move out of Russia.
How often do you speak to her?
So I speak to her, you know, a couple of times a week.
Nice.
It's the last thing that we have working is WhatsApp, honestly. Because I can't even send her a postcard because U.S. Postal Service would not accept any mail to Russia.
Yeah.
There is a kind of a back door through the European company. You can send her like a little bit to gift basket and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have relatives in Italy who are constantly traveling back and forth because I have a big business in Russia and had that since the 1970s, really, back in the Soviet days as well. And I try to squeeze a little bit of, you know, something to send to her with them. So that kind of helps. But apart from that, you know, between the pandemic and now, I have not seen her physically.
What does she think of the progress of the special military operations?
Well, I mean, she's a kind of a firm supporter of what Putin is doing. It's understandable for many reasons why. It's impossible to talk to her and so about this. So we kind of try to talk about friends, family, and, you know, the weather and, you know, things like that. But in basic terms, she's very grateful to Putin for creating stability after the 1990s. Mm-hmm. During the 1990s, you know, she was in a situation where my family members and herself were, you know, their lives were put under the contract by the mafia. I mean, so there is understandable why she would be harboring positive views for the stabilization, for the economic improvements and things like that. She's not political. So as a result of that, she doesn't harbor any views on, say, opposition or on democracy or on policy side of the politics or on the institutional side of the politics as well. In her view, the world is much more simple and more straightforward. We have stability. The government does invest. The government does help people like her. She's a pensioner. She gets a reasonable pension. She is not, you know, financially in a huge need. She's certainly not wealthy by any possible means, but she has access to healthcare. She tells me about, say, for example, things like how the transport systems are operating. And when you actually think about that and compare that to how, say, even transport systems operate in Ireland,
yes,
you go like, wow, you know, you mean that actually stuff arrives on time? Yes. You mean that you can truck the, for example, transport, you know, like a bus or a, you know, tram, you know, throughout lifetime on your app? Yes. You mean that the pensioners actually have, and, you know, people with disabilities have free access to transport? Yes. And then you can start to understand that on the ground, people living through this special military operation, most of the Russians are not necessarily suffering tremendously. They suffer on the things like, say, for example, access to their relatives abroad. They suffer on the side that a lot of Russian younger men left at the beginning of the special,
so who's fighting
special military operation. Well, I mean, conscripts.
Yes.
So not conscripts who are forced conscripts. That's actually volunteers. They're paying well, so they're hiring, you know, professional or hired military. They give them some training and they send them onto the front lines. There's a lot of misconception in the West about this as well, because we have a lot of actually kind of misinformation and misrepresentation.
Namely?
For the ideological reasons. Namely that, for example, you know, people who are recruited there are not necessarily just shipped straight off to die. They're actually trained. I mean, that the Russian army does sustain significant losses, but those losses are nowhere near the figures that come out of the Ukrainian sources, which we repeat here in the West.
Well, what losses would you stand by as was more reliable?
Oh, look, no, I can't, you know, I can't tell you the figure because I don't know. Mm. Okay. Now, nobody knows. Nobody knows the true Ukrainian losses. Nobody knows true Russian losses.
Right.
I would surmise that they're fairly sizable, but Russia so far has not had a problem recruiting troops.
Yeah.
And there is reasons for it. It has larger population than Ukraine. Of course, that's true.
Mm.
Demographics of the population are very similar. Emigration has taken out many more younger men out of Ukraine than it did from Russia.
Mm.
And what's interesting about that is that the sanctions against Russians that apply also within Europe have actually effectively pushed back a lot of Russian, you know, immigrants out of Europe back into Russia. So in a way, we have supplied younger people to Putin's army from Europe when they actually left in 2022. By 2023, about 500,000 of them returned back, primarily driven by the fact that they can't even get their bank accounts opened.
Wow. Because of sanctions?
Yeah, because of sanctions. Because we're stupid enough to impose sanctions on ordinary people.
Jesus, that is stupid.
Thinking that we're going to actually hurt Putin through that.
You said, I mean, I know, look, I know you have no problem in making prognostications and predictions and everything. And, you know, economists predict things all the time. But I remember you were on Dunphy in the stand and Dunphy was there. You know, it was about 2 years ago, I think. So when should we expect, Constantine, the Russian economy to go tits up, baby? And you were there. I expect maybe in 2 months it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it hasn't.
You bet. No, it hasn't.
Why?
Mean, and I've been on both Dunphy since then and, you know, in other outlets. I mean, mea culpa. One of the things you learn after having a lifetime of experience with economics is that stop making prognostications because you will never be right unless randomly, okay? So don't trust any economist who says X will happen, okay? Actually, you probably are better off betting that Y will happen as a result of that, okay? Or maybe A will happen, but certainly not X, okay? But anyways, yes, we expected that the weight of sanctions and the weight of war combined will relate to the oil, will translate into Russian economy literally imploding. This expectation was 2 months and was then 6 months. There's, oh, well, once we tighten the sanctions, there are still people, you know, like, say, for example, at the Institute for International Policy, Economic Policy in Washington, D.C., a very big think tank, who are literally pumping themselves in the chest saying that, The only reason sanctions are not working is because we are not hard enough in imposing them. I mean, short of us going out there and starting to use submarines to sink boats in the middle of international waters, sanctions are not going to work as we expect them to work. In the long run, they degrade the ability of the Russian economy, beyond any doubts. In the long run, they degrade the ability of the Russian society to innovate, to be entrepreneurial, to invest in the future, beyond any doubts. That long run, however, is decades. And you can see that decades, even in the case of the political regimes like, say, for example, Cuba, are not even that enough. And there is an embargo, I mean, as in like hardcore embargo, you know. You can't do that with a country the size of Russia. You can't do not just geographical, but also economic power, okay? You can't do it with the economy which is as diversified as the Russian economy is. Remember, we had this political class in Washington, D.C. and in Brussels, which was saying, oh, Russia, it's just a gas station with a little, you know, something attached to it, with a small economy attached to it. But in reality, Russia is a robust economy in many ways, okay? It is capable of innovation. It is capable of finding the ways to bypass sanctions. It has the largest economy in the world, China, which is its strategic partner.
Yeah.
It has managed to preserve and enhance its long-term relationships, both economic and political, geopolitical relationship, with the largest non-aligned economy in the world, India. It has been able to create a relatively coherent trade and investment, if you want, block within the BRICS. And of course that block has been created primarily by a combination of China and Russia. And as a result of that, Russia is insulated itself from the Western sanctions pretty much.
And it's got its own about it, and sorry, just in a more humorous note, it's compensated for the fact that it was kicked out of the Eurovision Song Contest. It's restarting its own Intervision Song Contest.
No, I don't think anything can actually match the reach, the scope, and the depth of the Eurovision Song Contest.
The Intervision Song Contest, the Intervision Song Contest is unbelievable. So basically, they've got Brazil, Cuba, North Korea all entering songs.
And North Korea, excellent.
North Korea once won the Intervision Song Contest. Do you know what the name of their song was?
No, go for it.
I fell in love with a disabled army veteran.
No, you're kidding me.
It was. That was a North Korean song that won the Intervision Song Contest.
Well, there is hope then. DEI is obviously penetrating North Korea as well, rapidly. You know, it will take it down too.
Konstantin Gurdjieff, thank you very much for talking to me. And my thanks, of course, as always, to Konstantin Gurdjieff, and hopefully he'll come over in the next few months and we'll be able to sit down and have dinner together. My thanks to you, of course, for all the love you gave this podcast and for telling one other person, if you can, about this podcast. Any suggestions for sketches, guests, please get them into me, mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I read all the emails and I get back to most of them. My thanks again to deluxebathrooms.ie. The sale is now on until March 2nd, the Love Your Bathroom sale. Get in there, up to 70% off in store. Deluxebathrooms.ie. Thanks to you guys. We see you same time, same place next week.